Welcome back to the Groups Matter podcast. I am Brian Daniel, and I am here today with co-host Joel Polk. Rick Howerton normally with us, but Rick took it upon himself to go get double knee replacement, and he has been forbidden to do anything remotely associated with anything here. But we're happy to have Joel with us today. Joel is the lead content editor of our Discipleship Publishing. So, Joel, how are you doing?
Man, it's so good to be here. I by no means want to take Rick's spot.
Nor could you, my friend. Nor could you.
But it's so good to be here with you and to talk through all thing groups. So tonight, I wanted to...
Yeah, I was going to say, it's springtime. Yeah. So, I mean, this is we're just on the other side of daylight savings, which is like a holiday for me.
Mm-hmm.
So in your life, that translates...
Well, you know, it translates for me right now for church softball. It's coming around the corner, and tonight is the first practice for church softball. So,
how many years have you been doing?
Oh man, maybe close to 10 years, and I've gotten worse every year. But I say this:
stick around.
I loved playing flag football, but those days are behind me. Church softball, we can, you know, sit behind the plate and run.
Just tee off, yeah, on it. So you gave up. You gave up flag football, yeah, but you still do basketball, right?
Oh, not as often.
So that's diminishing.
Yeah,
that
diminishes as well.
So you're left with church, yeah, league softball,
and then eventually
seems like a natural progression, yeah, or regression.
So eventually, I'll either stand behind the or kneel behind the plate and catch a ball, or toss it to catch.
don't ever be a church league softball catcher.
Yes. Oh, the day will come. I've heard that you have some past experience with
you
with
would
church
bring
softball.
That up.
Yes.
Yeah, I do have a church. I have a church softball history. That is true. I played for years. We played in Georgia. Played some in Tennessee when we moved here.
And you're when a slugger, weren't you?
Well, yeah. So you're gonna make me go there, right? So we lived in New Mexico for a while, and I'd given it up. My girls had gotten old, and just being gone a couple more nights of the week and being out with the guys, it wasn't a good trade off. But I got talked into it. And
coming
I actually
out of
played.
Retirement.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They wheeled me out. I was like Wes Unseld for the wheeling me out. But actually, I was a middle infielder. What do you play middle?
Outfield. Yeah,
yeah. You're outfield. You've got, mm-hmm, the speed. So, you know, New Mexico is known for the altitude. Mm-hmm. So I think we played at like 7,000 feet. Yeah. I know I lived at 7,500. I think Santa Fe was 7,000 feet where we played.
Right.
And as a middle infielder, you know, I was always a base runner and, you know, doubles and singles. Mm-hmm. I just like getting on base.
Yeah,
and every now and then I would get a hold of one, mm-hmm, as they, you know, you've heard that term.
Mm-hmm.
I'd get a hold of one, and I could hit it over the outfielder's head. And this time, I did, and I knew that I had burnt, you know, one of the center fielders, either right or left.
Right.
And so I took off and think this is gonna be easily a triple, and we'll see if we can make a play at home.
Yeah, sure.
And so I was rounding third, and the third base coach said, "Why are you running so fast?" And I didn't realize the ball had actually gone over the fence.
Setting a record.
It was over the fence, not an inside the park, over the fence home run. And so I tell people that I set the world record for expediency around the bases.
Yeah.
So the one time that I did it, I was trying to leg out a triple, and I completely robbed myself of the home run try. I should have flipped the bat. I should have, you know, showed up the pitcher and took my time around the bases, really created, yeah, stories, because it never happened.
So
again,
tell me about that. What
changed
that
my life.
What did that do to your swing? Because you know, there's a different type of swing. So I still, yeah, am in that.
So you remember that too.
I'm still, yeah, in that. Let's just get to first, okay? And if I can get it in the outfield, maybe I can get to second. So what did that do to your swing?
Well, from that point forward, regardless of the situation, I felt like I could end the game.
Yeah, swing for the fences.
Yeah, I could end the game. I remember, yeah, and I think I had two or three games left and popped out every at bat after that. Ruined me.
That's funny.
I haven't played much since. But, yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
Bring that.
It is. It is springtime, and, you know, softball is a great way to get men to church, I think, and to get men engaged in group life even. And I always enjoyed it for developing relationships. So anyway, Joel, thanks for being with us. We've got a great show. We've got a great show this episode. I don't even know what episode we're at, but we're moving on up there. Appreciate everyone tuning in and downloading us. Thank you, all your listeners. Rick is gone for a little while, but not forgotten.
And so on the post of the week, we've got Rick Howerton's Undeniable Facts, Why Starting New Groups Isn't Optional. And he's also, of course, responsible for the Rick's List, which seven audacious practices for those who lead icebreakers effectively. And Rick, as well as I, am a big advocate of the icebreaker. So we'll be looking at the ways that you can do that. I don't always call it an icebreaker, but just a way to get everybody talking in the group.
Sure.
And with us today, we have Philip Nation.
Yeah, Philip.
Philip Nation is a local pastor, but has led the group work here before and has written actual group studies for us. And so Philip's going to be with us today talking about his work with a new project on the basics of church. Was understanding church basics, right, Joel? Right. You actually headed that project.
Yeah, it's really examining some of the foundations of a healthy church, and so he helped us out with that, drawing some of the foundations of what it means to be a church member, and he was great to help us out to draw some of those basics out and to give the church member some things to hold on to and their role as a church member. So,
yeah. And Philip has a new book that released just a few weeks ago,
right.
Habits for Holiness. And so we'll probably get into some questions about the pursuit of holiness and where and how that intersects with group life. So I'm sure he has some thoughts on that. And then as always, tweets of the week, one of our most popular segments backed by popular demand. So, hey, ready to get started?
Yes, let's go.
All right, so let's look at this week's post of the week. And this post is brought to us by none other than our friend Rick Howerton. And I found this at rickhowerton.wordpress.com. And Joel, this is Undeniable Facts, Why Starting New Small Groups Isn't Optional. I think the whole idea of new groups, I mean, that's foundational to church life, but I think it also scares people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad that we got Rick in this podcast, even though he's not here with us. This is a really good article, let me just give an overall view. He talks about how every group's pastor that he ever met, they all had a passion for starting new groups. But the problem is that you had to get everyone else on board, right? So you had to get the pastors on
board.
Sell
them on it.
Right.
Yep.
You had to get buy-in. The group leaders, the coaches, and everyone on board. And that's a little bit more difficult. I love he compares it to like getting mice to purposefully march into a series of mouse traps. And so I loved how he gave that illustration. And then he gives some ammunition for us for the group leaders so they can use to convince people that starting new groups is really non-optional.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. He says group points people, if they're going to start new groups, need ammunition they can use to convince people, basically get buy-in from starting new groups is non-optional. And I like that term, non-optional. He's not just saying this is a good thing to do or this is what you should do. He said it's not really an option. You need to grow your ministry. You need to grow your groups. And so he says there are many great reasons to start new groups. A few of those would fall into two categories, or what I may call Rickisms.
Right.
And he divides these two categories. He says there is the three shuns, which is not S-H-U-N-S. It's the T-I-O-N-S, the three shuns.
That's right.
And the four creates.
Yeah, this is really helpful. So the first shun is assimilation. And so he says when people visit a church, that one of the first questions that they're asking themselves is will I be able to find and make new friends, right? That's the first thing that really people are looking to see if they can fit in with this group of people. And so small groups are the perfect place to meet and to get to know people. And if a church is going to assimilate people into the church, starting new groups is really a must. Shun is justification.
Well, you have to emphasize. You have to say justification.
Shun, yeah. Justification. He defines justification as simply being made righteous in the sight of God. And so it's realizing one's need for a Savior and then allowing the blood of Christ to cleanse them from all unrighteousness. And so,
Rick says, for those who are not yet followers of Christ, there's no better place for them to hear the gospel, process the gospel, see the gospel lived out in the lives of a few believers and choose to receive the transformational power of the gospel. So he's actually saying that this is the best place for evangelism.
Right. Yeah.
Is new groups, not just a group, but new groups.
Oh, right. That's great. And then the last one, he uses is sanctification, and he defines sanctification as the stage-by-stage growth that takes place as someone becomes more like Jesus Christ. And this happens really in community, right? I've heard it said like this. We did a product with Eric Mason. It was on sanctification. From his book Unleashed. And so we did a companion Bible study for it. And he compared sanctification to a sculptor. See, I would look at a rock or something that you're actually going to sculpt, and I would see how I can turn that rock into something beautiful, right? But he says a sculptor doesn't think like that. He looks at the image. He can see the image inside of the rock. Yeah. And so the sculptor's job is just to remove all the things that gets in the way of that beautiful image seeing. And so that's what sanctification is. It's just a tearing apart those different things to make us look like Christ. And so I thought that was really helpful.
I've heard Rick say before that transformation obviously happens in many places in many ways, but it best happens within the context of community.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I think that's what he's getting at here. A new group is basically a way that you can start the journey together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right. Instead of stepping into the middle of the story.
That's right. That's right. So he goes through those shuns, and then he talks about the four creates. And I thought that this was super helpful. Anything new, like we know, anything new creates a sense of anticipation and is a magnet for many people, right? We know that through church plants. Church plants tend to grow faster because it's something new. It's something different.
And each, new movements grow faster than old movements because they've lost their newness.
Right? That's right. And each time a new group is started, those who may not be in those that may not be in a new group or in a group feel like they don't belong. And so creating new groups allow people to want to be involved. And so that's really his first create is creates.
He's got four of these. There's four of these creates.
Yeah. There's four here. The first one is creates space for newbies, right? So starting a new group with the correct number of people creates space for those who aren't in a group, but are in the hunt for one. So I think that a lot of times when you go into a new group, you feel like you're not really connected, right? There's inside jokes, there's relationships that are
or an existing group.
Right, an existing group. Yep. That are already, happening in a group. And so that's the reason there's an importance to create new groups is
furniture.
Because,
in our house there's a furniture part of the equation.
Okay.
Just a pure practical that a new group just gives a lot of times with the existing group, all the seats are taken.
Right.
It's just a basic. Now you can always pull in more chairs, but even more of a reason, in the post, Rick points out that there's just not room sometimes to add more people.
Right.
So it's just a very practical need for new groups for new people.
That's right. The second create he lists is creates a safe place for newbies. Starting a new group gives newbies equal footing and a chance to join others who are beginning the journey at the same time together. I thought that was really helpful. It creates a unity within those newbies. You're starting this journey together. You're in it for the long haul. I thought that was really helpful too.
Well, and this one kind of gets to what I was pointing at with an earlier comment. It's existing group is like stepping into a movie that's been going halfway through a movie into the theater. It can be a little disorienting. You don't know the characters. You don't know the voice. You don't know the tone, and you're missing a large part of the plot. And so when you can begin as a group with the new group, you take a lot of that out of play, which creates a safe place. It's this idea of being known and belonging. So I would contend that there's more ownership with the new group.
Mm-hmm.
This is not to say that you don't continue adding to existing groups,
mm-hmm.
but the non-optional part of this is one of the creates part that Rick's pointing out.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was really strong.
And along with that point, the third one goes along with that kind of family idea. It's creates a family for those in need of a family, right? So starting new groups makes it possible for those who need a room full of Christian brothers and sisters to do life together and to go. This is a journey, right? This is a life journey together to connect and become a family. So I thought that third point was really helpful too.
Is it out of place here to maybe use a birth analogy with family?
I guess we have to now, right?
Is that a reach? I'm trying to figure it out. Maybe birth is overused, but there is this aspect of being kind of a group being born together that does contribute to the family, the family component, I think, that kind of with the second create we pointed out about the safe place for newbies, a family is absolutely that, and it's also a place to be known. But there is that additional component of that bond that begins to develop because you're kind of in on something. It's almost being like a found at a lesser level, being a foundational member of a church.
That's right. Yeah, that's good. And then finally, that fourth create is creates a safe place for stories to be told. I love this. This is actually a passion, something that took a lot of work just in my own journey as a small group leader. But as we tell our stories, God redeems our stories, right?
I love that language.
Yeah. So Rick says that each time a new group is started, those who make up the group have the opportunity to speak openly about their dark past and their journey as a believer in Christ. And so it allows others to become vulnerable and so, yeah. So that's a great point too. It starting new groups is helpful for that.
Yeah. The first three create new space, create space for newbies, creates a safe place for newbies, creates a family for those in need of a family. It seems like the natural culmination is when you get to number four, which is create a safe place for stories to be told. Because when you're getting into some of those areas of life, some of those corners, some of those crevices that we would rather avoid, you're going to need the things in the first three. So new groups, I would say the purest in group ministry may be the purest way. Or maybe I'll put it this way, the most direct path to transformation is new groups. Also, probably in group life, the hardest thing to do. So in your experience, so you started your group, right?
Well, I mean, I came in. Actually, I was a part of a new church plant, and so I was one of the first groups.
So you were born out of that plant?
So we've had several groups that have come out of my group, and it's not an easy task. I remember the first group that we planted. We like to have a group planting mindset in the same way that a church planting mindset.
It's a good term, group planting.
And so it's healthy because it gets the group thinking about what it looks like to be open to the idea of planting a group in the same way it allows a church to be open to planting a new church. So one of the hardest things for us to do is to let go of people from within our group to plant a new group. And so one of the things I think it's helpful to do is to train up leaders and to equip equip guys in your group to be able to do what you do. I think that's a helpful thing. But just to give a vision of what planting groups, you know, is, and to encourage them in that. And so, yeah, there's a lot of challenging things, but it's unbelievably important to start new groups. So
how successful do you think you've been in creating that safe place for stories to be told?
Better at times and not as...
So it's a little bit of a moving target.
Oh, yeah, sure. And I think that naturally people look at the group leader as the person that has it all together, right? And we know that that's not the case. But the better the group leader is able to open up his own heart and to be vulnerable in front of the group, the better environment it is for others in the group to feel open to talk and to share their own life stories. Cause that's what we want to do. We don't want this to be a Bible study in a sense that you're just gaining biblical knowledge. You want to take that knowledge and what you're learning and apply it to your own life. And you can't do that if you're not talking about how it's changed your own life and how you've gone from where you are to where you are now. And so I think it's unbelievably helpful for groups to be messy, for them to look messy. And it starts with the leader, I think.
That's Undeniable Facts, Why Starting New Small Groups Isn't Optional. And this is at Rick Howard, this is at Rick's blog, rickhowerton.wordpress.com. Good post. If that's not on your regular reading, you might ought to consider putting it there. So next up, we're going to have Philip Nation here. He's actually going to be in the studio. This is a live guest, which is up in the ante a little bit. This is where the host, we've got hors d'oeuvres on the table. We've got all kinds of like coffee. We have, what were some other things that were in Phillips Ryder? He was one of the more demanding guests I think we've had. Actually, I'm making all that up.
All green M&Ms.
It couldn't be further from the truth. Yeah. So we're going to have Philip here. So Philip is the author of, most recently, of a book from Moody Press called Habits for Holiness. But Philip also contributes to a lot of projects with Lifeway and has other books to his own name. And his most recent contributions, and he's a co-writer for Basics, understanding the foundations of church.
Of a healthy church.
A healthy church, right. I always have a hard time remembering that subtitle. So Philip's going to be with us. What are you most excited about talking with Philip about?
Oh, well, just the knowledge he brings. He's a pastor. He's helped us, like you've said, with a lot of different products, and in those products he has to be able to craft questions for a group, and so just the knowledge that he brings to this conversation I think is going to be extremely helpful for us. So I'm excited about it.
So without further ado, let's welcome Philip here. He's just come into the studio. So Philip Nation, how are you doing, bro?
I'm doing great. Thanks for letting me be on the podcast with you guys today.
Well, good to have you, and you're certainly a man of letters around these parts with a successful blog, a lot of books, and you write in a lot of different ways. I think you have not dabbled in fiction, but you're close with one of your projects, really close.
I am. Thinking through a project where we're going to, I and a friend of mine are going to explore the fears and the character and the hopes that are all behind the stories that we tell that include monsters and anti-heroes mm-hmm. and dystopian futures.
But most recently, and this will be out in just a few weeks after this show post, is the Basics Project. So we want to talk with you about that and just how this idea of the fundamentals of a healthy church plays itself out in group life. Now, we've done projects like this before that was more for leadership. We felt like that we had a content gap where groups were concerned, and we feel like that it's important for groups to understand just the basics of how church works. So you just came off that fairly intense assignment addressing the basics of ecclesiology. What surprising insights about small groups and group ministry emerged out of that process?
Yeah, hopefully I was able to bring a relatively unique perspective because I serve as a pastor bivocationally alongside of the other work that I've done, where I get to visit with a wide swath of churches on our continent and beyond, and then serving as a writer myself. And so the whole idea about ecclesiology, what's the theology behind a church, how is it formed, one of the very basic, to steal the word of the title, ideas that I wanted to communicate is that if you carelessly walk through the process by which a church is formed and how it's structured, then you will stumble when it comes to the mission of the church. And so helping people to translate the theological teaching that they will oftentimes get through the Sunday morning sermon and through kind of the 1:30 to 40, depending on minute, kind of message, depending on your church, into the conversation of a small group. There were parts of it that were very challenging. How do you help a small group to talk about the structure and the practices of a church, which, I mean, just to be quite frank, is not boring? How do you make that a lively discussion? But really found what I hope to be some very interesting ways for people to access their own stories and their own histories, and make that comparative to, okay, so what does the scripture say about this, and let's let the scripture guide our future stories. So
it's not the most natural
thing. It is not, and it's not one of the things that we talk about in small groups now. I'll definitely say not enough. I would have said before, we're not talking about this enough. Now that I've been through this process of helping to craft and write and form up a study, I see how the small group could have a powerful influence on the life, the total life of a church.
Yeah.
And just so everybody knows, and Joel can help us out here, this is six different sessions on six different aspects of a healthy church.
Right.
Stewardship, understanding church discipline.
Well, you're going to go out of order, so you're going to mess this up.
All right, Joel, step in, yeah.
Well, it's understanding.
Bail me out.
Understanding congregational authority, right? And then to understand the Lord's Supper and baptism, okay? And then the third would be understanding stewardship, like you said. And then also one thing that a lot of times churches don't want to talk about is understanding church discipline, what that looks like in a healthy church. Then we also wanted to talk about understanding church leaders and how that plays itself out in a biblical model. And then finally, understanding the Great Commission and so what that looks like also.
Yeah, and in all of those, there is this opportunity that churches have that they have to fight against, where they tilt all into one or another direction. They run to the end of the spectrum of this is a whole church thing, or they run to the end of the spectrum of this is an individualistic thing. Certainly with the session on stewardship, oftentimes that gets posed as, well, this is just what you do in your private life. Don't let anybody else know, you know, what your tithes and offerings are. That needs to be secret. Make sure you put the offering envelope up, you know, face down in the plate so nobody can see.
Right.
But instead, what we've got in the New Testament is this great witness of how congregations were stewards of the resources that God entrusted to them collectively. So that was a fun session to ride and try to dig through to help small groups have that discussion, not just about how do I individually work as a manager of the resources God's given me, but how do we, you know, once we get all this together, what do we do next with it?
I just don't think groups have a real good idea of just church and how it works at the ecclesiological, biblical level. It's something we do. It's some place we go to. There's people that we see. But the nuts and bolts, the mechanics, the biblical side of it is something that in group life I think has been neglected. This isn't a study that you go through as a group, you know, multiple times maybe, but I do think that it's foundational.
That's right. And Philip, help us out real fast. How can a group ministry benefit from a deeper knowledge and understanding of church basics and really even just the ecclesiology and the biblical model for how a church works?
Well, I think, first of all, it helps groups to continue to feel like they are a part of the whole. Every once in a while, again, we find groups in churches. Maybe you've got one in your church as you're listening in on this, or maybe you're a part of one that you've begun to feel like we're kind of an island unto ourselves. We're almost like a little mini congregation inside of our congregation. And to have a proper ecclesiology, understanding of the whole church, you're able then to fight against that impulse of separating our own group and our own ministry. We do our own thing over here from the whole, but instead to participate in what God is doing for the life of the congregation. But then also, the other thing I would say is, you mentioned one of the sessions was on church discipline. We have a really, I think, an awkward view of church discipline as a whole.
That's right.
Because of what we carry as our baggage, our emotional baggage about what is discipline. Well, we think about being disciplined as children correctively by our parents, and it stops there. Whereas what's in Scripture and what we have proposed through this study for groups to be able to mine through is that there is a formative discipline that a lot of times we'll call it discipleship or accountability. We've got other words for it. But very, I think it is a realistic way for us to look at how groups, how they do that formative discipline in people's lives to help them get toward godliness and holiness, which obviously I've got a vested interest, as we all do, about those issues as well, and how groups can help push that forward rather than just being the repositories of biblical factoids that we dump on each other.
Right. And we look at all of those different topics and we think, oh, well, that's for someone else. That church discipline, oh, that's for someone else. Great Commission, that's for someone else. Stewardship, maybe even, that's for someone else. And so I think that this is a really helpful study for us to see how the church member's role is so very important for the church as a whole. We're not just, it's not just a consumeristic type of understanding, but in our role, we're able to cultivate and to build up what a healthy church is really supposed to look like. So
I think at some level I want to say that this is an instance where ownership confronts and combats hierarchicalism. So instead of just top down, exactly what you're saying, that this is a message that starts with the pastor and just is forced down to people and they either accept it or not. This is a swell within the group's community that creates an attitude of ownership among these things, particularly church discipline, which awkward is a mild way of putting it. I think it's underutilized, and I think it's also probably misunderstood. So that's one of the sessions of this particular study. I think I wouldn't say that it's most beneficial, but maybe to me most interesting anyway, because you just don't see a lot about that in this context.
And I think a lot of times because it gets compartmentalized. That's why the study starts with the session on congregational authority. And that doesn't mean that the congregation is going to have a weekly business meeting and vote on every single little detail of that's going to be done. Of, you know, are we going to, you know, and of course the go-to illustrations are, you know, the color of paint on the walls or the carpet that we're going to put in. I've got my own story that one of the first churches that I served in, I remember still to this day very clearly, and it's more than two decades ago, a business meeting where we had a 20-minute debate. It was not a friendly discussion. It was a debate about how many brooms to buy and what kind of brooms. Well, those things have got to be decided by somebody, but that doesn't help your ecclesiology. And so the idea of the authority holding together, the congregation holding the authority together of the gospel, what is the gospel, and holding one another account to the gospel, then fuels us doing the Great Commission together. It fuels us doing formative discipline together. It fuels what good leadership looks like.
Categorically, there are three components here: church leadership, congregational authority, and groups. As you were writing this small group study, did a different understanding, perhaps, of the relationship between church leadership, congregational authority, and groups begin to emerge?
Yeah, I don't know that it began to emerge for me. Hopefully I was a little bit along the way, but it certainly was a refining process for me. I found it to be an enjoyable exercise to discipline my own theological grid that I'm working through, to make sure that I was not putting up firewalls in between these things. Well, you know, the congregation votes on this stuff, and then the church leaders are supposed to do those things, and then the small groups are just supposed to kind of operate underneath the surface. But instead, seeing the interconnectedness of all of this together really, I think, refines my own thinking that, because I, like you guys, I believe that a healthy groups ministry is going to catalyze growth in the church and transformation in people's lives. I think growth happens best among friends, both old and new, and the groups ministry is the environment where that can take place. So for me, it just helped to once again drive home the interconnectedness of all of these operations within the church.
All right, last question. Habits for Holiness is only recently released. Mm-hmm. So you've just come off what I would assume is a fairly exhaustive enterprise of pulling that manuscript together and seeing it get to print. And at about the same time, you were working on this project.
Right.
How much bleed over this idea of the holiness and the pursuit of holiness? I think it's just really interesting to me. I've read a couple of books recently. One of the things that stuck out was to pursue holiness, you have to believe it's possible. You have to, even though you know that's way out there, and to personal holiness is one of those things, it's like this holy grail mm-hmm. mentality. How, you know, and this is off the subject of basics, how do those two things work in tandem as you were working? Because that doesn't happen a whole lot, that you get the ecclesiological aspect alongside of holiness here and really the disciplines.
Yeah, here's the connecting point for me, which I think is significant and has become more and more significant in my life as I have studied the spiritual disciplines, which is what Habits for Our Holiness is all about. And that is, spiritual disciplines are to be practiced both individually and collectively as a congregation for the purpose of God's mission.
That's good.
That our maturity is the fuel for what makes a healthy church, and a healthy church is what then drives us into the Great Commission of being the ambassadors for Christ. So it came along at a very timely opportunity for me that I had come out of the manuscript for Habits for Our Holiness, which it's got like the longest subtitle since the days of Puritans, How the Spiritual Disciplines Grow Us Up, Draw Us Together, and Send Us Out. And so it was a good opportunity for me to put into practice theologically some of the practical spiritual disciplines that we should do together as brothers and sisters in Christ, happily watching God set us our lives aside for his purposes, and then to come into basics as a Bible study project to then say, hey, this is how we do all of this stuff together because of our covenant relationship with Christ and thereby with one another.
That's good. Expand that some for us, if you don't mind, that Habits of Holiness and how that involves groups? How do you create that kind of culture within our groups?
Yeah, I think you begin by stating it very clearly in your group that your spiritual maturity is personal, but it's not private. You have to do it, but we're going to do it together. We're going to help one another through this process. And so that's why in basics, to talk about church discipline as not just being corrective, but being formative, then you say to one another, not out of spite or out of one-upmanship, hey, how are things going in your personal devotional life of prayer, Bible study, fasting, simplicity of life, where you're not trying to get your contentment from, you know, the next generation of iPhone or the next, you know, Jeep Grand Cherokee you can get, but how are you doing with your identity in Christ? Because we collectively participate in the identity of Christ as a church family. And so it's something that you say we're going to discuss, but then it is something that a small group can then enter in together to say we're going to do this practice for a certain season of time together, whether that's we're going to read through the New Testament or we're going to serve in this good gospel-centered social justice issue, or it is, hey, we're all going to train one another together for leadership inside the life of our church. You know, we've got somebody in our small group that feels called, you know, into vocational ministry, or the church has identified them to become a leader. Let's all participate together to help this person along. So that's where I just think we do ourselves a great disservice when we, again, take a spiritual discipline and separate it from the whole of how we interact with the church family.
Works for me.
I'm glad it does. I'm glad it does. I hope that Habits for Our Holiness as a book will help a lot of people for a lot of years. I wrote it intentionally to with the idea that this should be a timeless kind of idea that people can come back to over and over again to investigate how spiritual disciplines will facilitate growth with love as the core practice of the Christian life.
That's Philip Nation, guys, and philipnation.net is where they can find a blog post.
That is correct.
And you spend most of your time there writing in what way?
I write about the practical issues of how do we work out our faith on a daily basis, and then also issues of leadership for the church. I try to keep it on a level where anybody can access what I'm talking about, not long, lengthy blog posts, but instead normally short, punchy ones that you can consume quickly and use immediately.
You can follow Philip on Twitter at Philip Nation. That's with one L. Thanks for being with us, Philip.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
It's really good to have Philip on the show. He's one of my favorite people I've met in my time here. He's a lot of fun to be around. He's a great content guy, very down to earth, and just a fun guy to be around.
Yeah, it's great to work with him on several of the projects I've already worked on, and it's good to hear him tie both of the Basics product and the Habits for Our Holiness and tie that into what that looks like in our small group. So that was really helpful for me.
I really liked what he had to say about how groups would benefit from a deeper knowledge and understanding of church basics, which is what we were talking about, but really ecclesiology, and saying that it helps groups fight against the impulse to be an island.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I've never really thought about that before, but one of the tendencies of group life is to a degree, I think you can, if there's not some intentionality there, drift a little bit from the broader congregation.
Yeah, to be a mini church.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You know, and I don't think that's all that common. I just think that's just maybe one of the pitfalls out there.
Absolutely.
And so for the way that this can help us have a better understanding that this is contextual, that groups operate within a broader context and ministry of the church that has a vision, has a mission, biblical.
That's right.
And the way it's supposed to work to achieve that, I think that was solid.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
All right. You ready to move on to everybody's favorite segment?
Yeah, let's do it.
Tweets of the week. All right. First tweet of the week. This is from Robbie Gallaty, and this is at @RGALLATY. Robbie's a local pastor and friend of ours. Also a contributor, as fate would have it, to the Basics project on the video side. Robbie tweets, great life group meeting tonight at our home. It's great to live life with others in community. All right. I picked this one, Joel, because I don't know that every pastor sees it necessary to be a functioning part of a life group. In fact, I know pastors that aren't. And And I get it. The transparency that may be expected, maybe not everybody wants to do, but here's a guy that's willing to lead, and you said it earlier in the show, here's a guy that's willing to lead by example.
Yeah, that's good. I like this one. It's coming from the exec pastor at the EXEC pastor. He says this, when small group members meet one another's needs, they meet the expectations of biblical community. I love that. I love that the focus of this biblical community is to meet one another's needs, spiritual needs, even physical needs. So that, I thought that was a good one.
You know, I thought community was a kind of a wimpy word until I started digging a little deep into it and understood how intimate that word means. You know, living in the South and spending most of my time in the South, I don't need any more friends. But the truth is, you need a narrower definition and understanding of friends and community to kind of get you there.
That's good.
Next tweet of the week is from Alfredo Canacia Jr. at POACH808. Before you invite a person, this is really cool. Before you invite a person to church or to a small group, make sure you invite them first into your life. Good heads up there. You know, and that's kind of it's the relational component, but how do you articulate this? But to invite someone in your life,
oh, yeah.
I think it just means just being you,
yeah, right.
Letting the you right. and you be a part of the relationship. I think a lot of the downside to churchiness or to the invitation is this facade that I'm trying to project someone that I'm not. And by inviting someone in your life, you diminish that aspect of this ethos.
Right, that's good. I've got a fun one here. This may be the winner, right? Jordan Cranda. Okay, he's posted a picture of a bunch of middle school students with all of their Nerf guns, and it says, "We had an epic small group Nerf gun battle throughout our church campus. Lots of fun plus minimal injuries equals success." Ha ha. Thought that was a fun one. And I love the fact that we can have fun in our groups also. This is obviously a younger group, a younger small group, but I love the fact that we can have fun and experience life together, but have fun while doing it. So.
Yeah, I would like to know what a minimal injury as it relates to Nerf. I thought the whole purpose of Nerf was no injury. Right. So they must have got pretty physical in their Nerf gaming.
That's right.
All right, that's going to do it for Tweets of the Week, this segment this week. Tweet us at Groups Matter or at Rick Howerton or at Joel Polk or at BC Daniel, and we'll pick that up and get it on a future show. We're going to move on to Rick's List. This week we've got 7 audacious practices of those who lead icebreakers effectively. An audacious practice of those who those words just don't seem like they should go together.
Right.
Do you use a icebreaker in your group?
This is hard for me, okay? Because when I lead small groups, I grew up understanding an icebreaker as a really corny practice or a fun game or those kinds of things. And so I think of either something with balloons or peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or
if you were a car, what would you be?
Right. And so that's what I think of when I think of icebreakers. But man, icebreakers are so important, and they don't have to be called icebreakers.
Right. I think that's part of the paradigm here, is what you call them.
That's right. And so these are really helpful. 7 audacious practices of those who use icebreakers effectively. And so
you don't know what the last icebreaker question I used was? I broke every rule.
Okay, go ahead.
Why is theology important? That was it. That was it.
Yeah.
So I had to. It was one of those that I had to go the next line and the next line and the next line to get people to understand what the question even was. So it's real important. The objective here is to get people talking.
Yes.
You just want people to, Rick would say, getting people used to hearing their own voice in the group. So that's the only objective of the icebreaker. Now, when we're developing resources, we're trying to entree into the content well and to kind of warm up that discussion.
Yeah, there's a creative way of doing that. But it's so very important because you want to be able to generate that conversation. And so there's a lot of helpful things here, I think, that that could kind of define healthy icebreaker types of questions. Let's start it off here. Number one. We've got when asking an icebreaker question, keep your tone light.
Number 2, audacious practice of those who lead icebreakers effectively is use questions that anyone can answer easily and none that demand a response that leads the group into deep or dark places. And that's just it's a terrible way to get complete lockdown in a group is to ask something. And one of the things, I think an example of this is something that would on the face seem benign, like your most embarrassing moment. Because I was one of the ones, as I've vetted them before, it's like, oh, that could be fun. might be fun for me. Someone else, it may bring back something that they don't want to remember.
Right. Yeah, number three, be an active listener when each person is responding to the icebreaker question.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, you have to be a listener in the group. I think that as a group leader, everyone's eyes are on you. And if they can tell that you're on your phone looking at the next question or looking at the next point that you're going to make, then they notice that. They take notice of that. And I think that it's important for you to be an active listener when people are responding to those kinds of
eye contact.
Oh, yeah.
Facial expression, nods. Audacious practice number four, after each person responds, affirm them for speaking.
That goes back to that. If you're listening, you can respond to those types of comments and affirm them, thanking them for sharing and saying that you look forward to your input and here in a few minutes as we talk further about those things. That's good. Number five here is when it's appropriate, be the first to laugh. What does that look like for you? The laughing it's obviously it has to be something that's,
it would be hard for me. I mean, you work with me, I'm not the quickest, I'm not the most demonstrative laugher. So
right.
I would have concerns about authenticity, I think, at that. But I think four and the two prior ones, three and four, play into this. If you're an active listener, I think you want to be affirming by responding the way that you think the group member is hoping you'll respond.
That's right.
And so, it's whatever is most natural for you. But I do think I think that's good. Be the first to laugh, and it sets a tone. And, I think most of us know, but it bears reaffirming. The more laughter is participation. And so if you're leading with the laugh and encouraging laughter, it makes for a much better group experience.
Right.
If you can get everybody kind of engaged right off the bat. So
I think
that's what's going on there.
Number six here, we have don't allow group members to ask follow-up questions of one another. This will hijack your evening.
A little bit of a surprise to me, but I think follow-up questions are good, but it does. You don't want the icebreaker to be 30 minutes.
Oh, that's right.
I don't know about you. I have been in situations to where it took forever to get into the Bible study content because no one stepped in, or I didn't step in if I was the leader, and cut these icebreakers off. Good hint here, he says. It's the next one. Number seven, keep people's responses as short as possible and be certain the overly talkative group member for anyone else doesn't get into telling a long story.
Right, number six leads into seven. Try to keep those responses short because you want to be able to get to that time and not to hijack your evening with rabbit trails, those kinds of things.
Do you have you been in a group before where you had long storytellers?
Yes, but can I be transparent? I was that person, so I have to limit myself some too, but yeah, of course. Yeah. And I think that whenever you have a small groups, right, Rick will often say a healthy group size is 12 or under that. I mean, you have limited, people to be able to contribute to conversation. So we don't know what that looks like. And if we're creating new groups and we always have different dynamics, we don't really know what's going to come. And so we have to kind of be on our toes and be able to know how to respond or cut off people without being rude. And so, let's try to keep those responses as short so you can get to the meat of the study.
It's huge because a good icebreaker question does two things. I think it naturally limits response, but it encourages responses because it's fun and a lot of times leads to storytelling. So there's an art to, not cutting people off and letting the icebreaker do what it's supposed to do, but also managing the time.
That's right.
And that's not the easiest thing to do. I think some of that has to do with just how you position the question. I think telling people ahead of time, hey, keep your, I can see Rick Howerton saying this. Try and keep your, try and just keep your reaction to 30 seconds or less, or your answer at 30 seconds. So I think that's a good heads up there, but that's huge because you can kind of wear that out.
That's good. Seven audacious practices of those who lead icebreakers effectively. This was really helpful from Rick.
RickHowerton.wordpress.com. So even though he is out with the double knee, he's present. He's with us.
That's right.
Well, Joel, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of Groups Matter Podcast.
Man, this was fun. Thanks so much for inviting me. I loved being a part of this time, and feel bad for Rick, but this was a really, really fun time with you, Brian. Thank you so much.
Well, Rick's out a long time, so you're just liable to show up on a following episode, right?
Well, we'll see.
Well, this episode is brought to us by Basics, Understanding the Fundamentals of a Healthy Church. And Joel was actually the lead editor on that project with the author, Philip. I actually pulled that content together. And you've heard us talking about it. What we didn't get into were the video contributors for this resource. So the way it's set up is Michael Kelly, who is an author here at Lifeway, also one of our leaders, has interviewed five different personalities to kind of introduce the content. Juan Sanchez was his pastor down in Austin.
He helped us with the church discipline topic, right?
H.B. Charles Jr.
Yeah, he helped us with
Florida.
Yeah, he helped us with the Lord's Supper and baptism.
Yeah, H.B.'s had a tough life. He born in California, and now he lives in Florida. I don't know if he knows what winter is.
That's right.
And then Robbie Gallaty.
Yeah, Robbie Gallaty. Yeah, Robert. He helped us with the Great Commission section.
And one of the favorite people we've met in the last year, Vance Pittman.
Yeah, Vance. He helped us with the stewardship session, and then finally we had Mark Dever, which helped us with a couple. He helped us with the congregational authority and with church leaders. So that was a really fun product to be with, because we were able to talk with so many great pastors and pick their brain on all of these different topics.
That will be available within a couple of weeks, so you can look for that. It's going to be great for groups, and something that's much needed. Thank you for joining us. Look forward to being in touch with you next time.